Hello and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I am universally respected film critic Daniel Barnes, but I go by many other names. The Barnes Yard. Dare Daniel, you might know me as. The Bone Temple, don't look it up. What I'm trying to say, Quirky, is I wear many hats, mostly I think what you lay people would call quote-unquote funny hats. I'm talking about your Cat in the Hat hats. I'm talking yes. about your inflatable fedoras, the oversized sombrero, the sombreros, or they got the dangling ball. I don't know what you call it. You know sure. what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Corky, these hats, they are all designed to rob me of my self-respect and strip me of my honor. And I tell you what, mission accomplished. And yet I sit here today with the distinct honor of introducing my co-host, the great Corky McDonald. Welcome, sir. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Let's have an encounter, but don't make it brief. Mm-mm. You know how I like it.
Close encounters of the briefest kind. That's what we
Close encounters in my briefs. Ew. Ooh.
Hey,
strangers. Just gets better from here.
So you said Barnes Yard, and Barnes I'm Yard. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I don't know when you're listening to this, but we're recording it the weekend going into Super Bowl 60.
Sure.
And
sure.
my team, the Seattle Seahawks, has a player named A.J. Barner. Anytime they need 1 yard, they run a play called the Barnyard.
The and it's Barnyard.
The tush push with A.J. Barner.
Interesting.
And I just learned this week, his name is Albert Javonte Barner. Stop what you're doing. Go look up A.J. Barner and tell me if you predicted that this man's middle name would be Javonte.
Javonte. A.J. Barner. Well, he's the Barnyard, and I'll give him that. I'll grant him that. And
you are the Barnes Yard.
I will do it with aplomb. Mm-hmm. I will do it with grace and
alacrity.
Magnanimity. Mm-hmm. Alacrity? I may not do it with alacrity. I might just take my time with it.
We're talking about brief encounters. This is we're trying to do things. Out.
I'm done with brief encounters, baby. Come on, I'm not in my 20s anymore. No more brief encounters. I'm in it for the long haul. Speaking of being in it for the long haul, Corky, I think we should talk about some people who are in it for the long haul. I hope so. They've been in it for the long haul. And we're in it for the long haul. But who else might be in it?
The only reason we're in it for the long haul is these beautiful people. The donors to our show, our PayPal supporters. And we want to thank each and every one of them right now. You guys are the heroes of the show. You are the Barnes Yard of our show. We couldn't do it without you, and we thank you so much for your support.
Mega dittos all the way around. And if you would like to donate to the show, if you'd like to join the League of Heroes, head to daredaniel.com, find the menu at the top of the show, click support the show, head to our PayPal. There's a donate button there on the homepage. You can make a one-time donation, weekly, monthly, yearly. I'm not sure how far they go in advance. I don't know, you know, I mean, how long will currency be? I mean, we're heading to a barter and trade sort of economy, so eventually you'll be able to pledge, like, I will fix your fence,
Of pelts.
You can share my grog, something, I don't know, yeah, just something. But anyway, for now we're taking cold hard cash, and any contribution keeps this show going. So thank you so much.
Tonight we're here to discuss David Lean's 1945 romance tragedy, Brief Encounter. The IMDb synopsis for Brief Encounter: meeting a stranger in a railway station, a woman is tempted to cheat on her husband.
Yes, this week's film, it's Brief Encounter, selected randomly at the end of our previous episode. It stars Celia Johnson, Trevor Howard, and Stanley Holloway. Directed by David Lean, written by Lean, Anthony Havelock Allen, and Noel Coward, based on Coward's one-act play, Still Life. Lean and Coward also worked together on Lean's 1942 debut film, In Which We Serve. Brief Encounter was shot in part at Carnforth Railway Station in Lancashire, And you may, I don't know if you've read the news today. Oh boy. 4,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. Quirky. I don't know if you read about this. And
I read the news today.
Sources are telling me that the holes were rather small, but they did have to count them all. Now they know him. Anyway. That's actually Noel Coward doing the station announcements in the film there. And it's interesting, you know, Noel Coward is at the time a closeted gay man, and you really wonder, is that's sort of like a potential subtext sort of running through this, of this story of forbidden love and people who have to sort of code their love and sneak around and kind of
inner monologues.
Yeah. The station refreshment room was recreated apparently pretty accurately in the studio. The film premiered in London November 26, 1945. Critics loved it. It did well at the box office. But really, from the moment of its release, this film has been consistently heralded as one of those essential films of British cinema. Of cinema in general, but British cinema especially. It just has that. Everyone's just so repressed, you know. It's just, it's so beautiful. And they drink a lot of tea. You know, so it just feels so British, and it's just a film that always, in its own sort of way, although it is old-fashioned, it still always feels relevant. It did actually tie in the very first ever Sight and Sound Critics poll back in 1952. Remember, they do this every 10 years, they take this poll, tied for number 10 in that poll. So again, like right from the very beginning, this was considered one of the, like, an exemplar of cinema, and again, an exemplar of British cinema in particular.
Wow.
Fast forward to the 2022 poll, it's tied at number 211 with 13 other films. So obviously it's fallen a bit over the last 70 years. But a lot of movies have come out in the last 70 years.
Yeah.
You know, The Godfather, Godfather 2. I won't go on. Godfather 3. As, you know, on and on and on, basically, is what I'm trying to say. I lost my spot. Tied at 211 with 13 other films, including Cannon Fodder, Cannon inductees like In a Lonely Place and Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mm. One of two lean films to make the top 250 in the 2022 poll. The other one's Lawrence of Arabia, tied at number 133. But no love for Dr. Zhivago, Bridge on the River Kwai, or his Dickens films or anything else. Brief Encounter was nominated for Best Director, Best Actress, and Best Adapted Screenplay Oscars. Lean himself was nominated for Best Director 7 times at the Oscars, won twice. In a 1999, the British Film Institute compiled a list of the top 100 British films of all time. Lean had 3 of the top 5 spots, including Brief Encounter. Readapted for the stage several times, as well as radio, remade for TV a couple of times. There was an opera in 2009. Corky.
Yeah.
I will keep it brief. Did you enjoy this encounter? And don't, you know, tell me outright. Signal with like hand gestures and just kind of the look playing across your face of whether or not this is go. No, actually, you know what? I will need words. Now that it's a podcast.
Yeah.
We'll need words. Just your face and like an inner monologue that none of us can hear is going to do nothing for us. So is this a canon-worthy encounter?
Well, Dan, I won't be a coward and keep it too lean on my review. I found this movie very compelling.
Mm.
The way it's set up, I'm not really a romance movie guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my bailiwick. I don't hate them, but they kind of got to do something different to get me into it. And this, I think, does something a little different. It got me into it. The central kind of conceit of it is that it's flashback, which is a David Lean kind of staple in some of his bigger movies. Mm. But it's flashback with an inner monologue, wall-to-wall, kind of almost Goodfellas-esque.
Mm.
We're watching Celia Johnson on screen in a really good performance, a great performance, really, reacting to what her inner monologue is telling us. So much so that I was wondering, I was like, were they playing the track of her narration for her to react to? They had to have, because there's movements and facial reactions.
So perfectly done.
So whether it's just her on screen alone or it's them two together, immensely compelling film. And David Lean has a deft touch. This is not the David Lean that I know. Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia, big grand spectacle. This is small. This is very small, close quarters, tight shots. And you see them out and about in the daytime, but it's nowhere near the spectacle of his later works. Mm-hmm. So I was in it, man, the whole way through. It's a really, really good film.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think a lot of people who the more the casual cinephile or just a movie fan, you might know Lean from Lawrence of Arabia and some of these later epic films, but that was the latter half of his career. You had this whole other earlier part in Britain, making mostly black and white films. It was Summertime was his first Western film, but he shows his mastery here. He shows it. It's just not, it's in a very kind of delicate, finely detailed way. He's doing it not through like crowd shots of thousands of people and camels marching across and these amazing like epic scenes of bridges blowing up and things like that. It's through light, it's through shadows, composition and editing and just like patience. And I love that you like singled out the narration, because yes, it is like omnipresent going throughout, but I love what the film actually is. Not usually my bag. I don't always go for narration. Okay, I think it can be a bit of a crutch, especially in a film, but man, I love what the movie does with it here, because we see this first sequence, right, which is like, as it turns out, the most pivotal like sequence in the film, and we're watching it right here, but we're watching it with only the most tenuous contextual understanding of what we're seeing. Like, we see this couple and we instantly were assigning things to it, right? Okay, yes, we get it. The friend comes in, the man rushes to leave, you know, she has this breakdown. We get a little bit of it, but we don't really get like the full feeling of it. And the whole movie is about giving it this full feeling. And it's all about her telling this to her husband, right? This monologue is not just a monologue to us, the audience. It is specifically her talking to her husband about this illicit affair, how it happened in every single detail, being honest in a way she could never be in real life, but she also will make small talk with him a little bit in there. Like, oh, you would have loved this thing here, right? Like, oh, this is just, remember that trip we took, you know, like she just kind of peppers it with it. And a few times, and this is done in like a real subtle way, but I think that we get some moments where we can actually sort of question her reliability.
Absolutely.
As a narrator, including there is one scene, and I think it's the only scene where she's not there, and it's between her lover and his friend, and so much seems to be assumed by that. But what is so great is like how much, as you said, it's got Celia Johnson. This movie lives on her face. It lives on her face. There's this amazing scene where they're just talking I think they're in the refreshment room, and he's talking about his work. He's prattling on about like coal dust inhalation. Nothing sexy. Nothing.
That's when she
falls
really
for interesting. Yes, and she just says, "You had a look on your face like you just got suddenly much younger." But whose face are we on that entire time? Yeah. We are on her face and what she's doing, what it's doing to her, how she's changing like that. I mean, and that's where this movie is that's the like kind of subtlety and the detail and the delicacy of this movie is those kind of details, you know. And it has this feel like this narration and the affair is sort of portrayed as like a dream. Right. Because she goes back to her first time meeting this guy, the narration, you know, she goes back to her husband. He's doing the crossword. He's her husband.
Hold on. If you haven't seen it and you're listening to this, sorry. When we're saying that she's telling her husband, she's telling him in her head. This is them
all
sitting
an inner
in the same
monologue.
Room, occupying space. So it's not actually telling him, but she's like Dan said, she's telling him in a way she could never actually say because she doesn't spare feelings. But she's still kind of talking to him, like Dan said, that she's like, remember I was buying this thing for your birthday. So if you have seen it, then you already know all this already. But I just want to clear that up, that it's not actually I'm confessing to you. It's telling
us. She's confessing
us.
Only in her head.
Yes.
Only in her head. But specifically, she's confessing to
also
her
as a
husband.
Way to relive it. Because it's just ending.
Reliving
she's
it, yes.
Us.
Because she's now, again, we're beginning at the end, which is another thing that I often hate when movies do, but it's done so fucking well here. It doesn't matter. Yeah. But yeah, we're beginning at the end and then going back, but she's already like, her life is over, basically, like as we're starting. And yeah, you're right. She wants to relive it. She wants to relive it from the beginning. She wants her husband to understand, but she will never, ever, ever be able to tell him the story. And it's a story of an affair. It's a story of an affair of a man who also has a wife, who also has a spouse and has kids. She has a husband and kids. And part of the remarkable complexity of this movie is that it doesn't lionize this affair. It doesn't condemn the affair or excuse the affair. So the illicit lovers, this is Laura and Alec. That's Laura Celia Johnson. Alec is Trevor Howard. I don't know if you would recognize Celia Johnson. Trevor Howard, if you've seen like the Brando Mutiny on the Bounty, he was Captain Bly. You'd know him if you've seen enough classic films. What I love about the... then there's the husband, Fred, who is not a jerk. Right?
No.
He's not an ass. He's not mean. He's not abusive. Like, ironically, he's just like, he's a bit of a twit, I guess. Like, he's the irony of his character is that he's constantly prodding her for clues in his crossword, and yet he has no clue. This guy is like without a clue. He might as well be a late 1980s film starring Ben Kingsley and Michael Caine. He is without a clue.
Deep he's just reference. Enough of a dim bulb with being a dad and being a husband, but he's not a bad guy. He's probably, if it was told from his point of view, there would probably be things that she doesn't pick up about him. You know what I mean? It's just they're
absolutely
they're in the malaise of post kids. They're well off, upper middle class, so they can afford to be bored.
Yeah. And that's the thing is like, it's not specifically like, it's not like she's Julianne Moore in Safe or anything like that.
Yeah.
Or like, she's like the abused wife in any sort of movie or anything like that. Or like the husband's an alcoholic or he's very sweet. He's a little golden retriever kind of guy. Well, let me get you into bed and give you a massage and maybe all the, you know, spa tea, have some brandy, whatever. Yeah. No, he's a good guy. And that's why this movie is so great at like why she's like often like kind of almost confused by like, why this has happened to her, like why she has just fallen so madly in love with this person who she doesn't really know that well. And the other thing that makes this sort of a much more complex Hollywood kind of thing, I don't want to get like superficial about it, but neither Laura or Alec are played by people who are what you would call like,
yeah,
it's not Salma Hayek and Channing Tatum or, you know what I mean? Like they are not like movie star hot. They're kind of, they're good looking people, obviously, but they just look like normal people, right?
Yeah.
This isn't something where it's just like, oh my God, like, yeah, it's Bo Derek and 10 just like ran across the beach and like ran right up to you. You know, like this is, it's very like, they're almost just, they don't really understand it themselves, but they connect as souls. But what I love, I'm sorry, getting back to my original point, what I loved about the narration and how it ties into this idea of like a dream. The narration's a dream. She goes away and he keeps saying like, you're miles away. You're miles away from me. Every time she's thinking about, even inside her description of it, every time she's thinking about Alec, Fred is like, you're miles away from me. And she's waking up from a dream. And I feel like this movie also has like a feel of a dream in a way. It's not like surreal or anything like that. But I think in a dream, you're the participant in the dream, but you're also the observer of the dream, right?
Yeah.
Like you're both watcher and watched,
yeah.
You know? And I think that's kind of like what we're getting here. And that also sort of plays in this other open secret relationship that goes on in the film, in the refreshment film, between Albert the ticket inspector and Myrtle the cafe operator, because she's constantly observing them from afar. She's kind of outside looking in on that relationship, just as they're outside looking in on her. We are identifying with her because we're constantly on her face. So like her, we are both inside looking out, outside looking in at the same time. And I think that's like, it's like, this isn't time bandits or anything like that. Like, it's not like literally surreal, but it is like, it does have that feel of like, I'm in a dream. I'm observing this behavior, but I'm also living the behavior. So anyway, I thought it was just, it's a, just a really, like I said, a complex film. One that I saw, you know, probably 25 years or so ago and did not appreciate on the level that I'm appreciating it now, for sure.
Yeah, there's a few things that you mentioned and a few things I took from it. It's about a span of a month and a half, maybe. It's a series of Thursdays that these people meet at this train station, and not just the train station. It's in this specific cafe, the refreshment area, before they start venturing out and going to do things together. They never get farther than kissing in their physical, but emotionally they do confess their love for each other rather quickly, like the third or fourth time they hang out.
Yeah.
Unreliable narrator aspect of it is even more than there's a part of it that she couldn't have possibly been around for, that she's filling in for what happens after she leaves an apartment where she was probably going to stay the night with him. There, she gives herself reasons. She'll be like, oh, I was just walking by the hospital. Like, just, but in reality, she wanted to walk by the hospital and look for him. But she's just like, mentions it as like, oh, I just happened to be by there. You know, oh, yes. I just happened to be sitting outside at that moment, you know. So she's unreliably giving herself outs. And one thing that really struck with me was that this day that she meets him on is her Thursday. This is her cheat day. This is her day where I'm not a mom, I'm not a wife, I'm but that usually manifests itself as just going to the movies, getting a new book, you know, doing some shopping for myself. It's like her own day. Had it been any other day that she met him, perhaps it wouldn't have been so on her mind to, you know, see this man again on this day. Mm-hmm. And that becomes
That's her day away from home, away from the suburbs.
Yeah.
Taking the train away by herself. She doesn't meet with friends. She doesn't, you know, she's usually just goes to do shopping or go to a movie by herself. Yeah, they're both, you know, yeah, it's funny because we don't really learn that much. They don't know each other very well, and we don't learn too much about them or like what their background or anything like that. But we get the impression they're both very lonely, just unsatisfied without being like, you know, miserable or anything like that. It's just sort of like they both have this sort of pang of loneliness that kind of, I think, first draws them together. But at first, as we find out, so, you know, again, we go through this opening scene, this really wrenching goodbye, which gets, you know, the wrench factor just wrenches up thousands of wrenches the second time we see this scene. Because for, again, like I said, we're only getting like, we have a brief idea of what's going on here, but we don't really get the full feel for it until later. But then we go into this flashback, and then, okay, so how do they meet? And it's just like all these coincidences, right?
Yeah.
They just kind of keep crossing paths. At first, it's just she has something in her eye. He's a doctor. Let me check it out. And he gets it out of her eye. And that's it. That's it. And then, okay, well, you know, he comes into the, you know, same train station on Thursday too. So they cross paths again, and then they cross paths again. And then it's like
each time it's a little more like a slow battle plan, like a little further advance.
Yes, exactly.
I sit and have lunch with you. We have an inside joke about something.
It's a little more intimate. It's a little more they're excited to see each other. And it's just, it's like so many coincidences start piling up that it begins to kind of feel like fate a little bit, right? Like even this musician, the same female musician who is playing in the train station, they go to the movie and she's playing a completely different instrument in the movie theater. And they're kind of laughing about it and stuff. But it's just like, it's this sense of like, okay, well, this is inevitable, right? Because, you know, it's the Matrix and I saw the same black cat twice or something like that, you know. But yeah, they're both like, they're very playful together in a way that we don't see her any other time. She's always she has a very grave look on her face a lot of the time, but she's playful with him and she enjoys her time. And you can just see her start to fall out for him. Like I said, you suddenly look much younger.
He actually listens to her, which her husband...
Yes.
He married listens to her.
Exactly, yes. He's listening as he's doing something else, and he's being encouraging, and that sounds great, dear, and all of that kind of stuff. But he's not really... Really, but they're always, the thing is though, so Alec and Laura, they're always rushing off, right? Like they're always in a rush. And again, this is like, as it gets closer and closer, they start to realize like, oh my gosh, like this is actually a real thing. It's not, we're not now running into each other. We're making plans to meet each other, you know? But it's just, they're always like rushing to catch the train. The train's leaving, they're going in different directions and they have to, you know, it's like,
talk about symbology. He needs to...
Yes, I know. But it's just like, they're always interrupted by, depending on how you look at it, cruel fate or merciful fate. Like it's always a friend pops by or something's about to happen. And then oh, your train's leaving. And then, oh, there's another friend, you know, like it's just always, it did make me think a little bit. I mean, so many movies, this movie is so like iconic and influential. So many movies you can say like, oh yeah, that reminds me of that. That reminds me of that. I did think In the Mood for Love, because in a similar way, like you have like these kind of like repressed cultures, 50s, I think, in The Mood for Love, and 40s here in Britain. But in both cases, I think like the lovers, like probably you know, spoiler alert for these old ass movies, but they don't get together.
Yeah.
But mainly it's because they don't have a place to get together. Like they just can't get together. Logistics wise, it's not going to work out. Like they just don't have a place to be together. Even here in the film, they find a place to be together. And wouldn't you know it, the friend comes home. Put a sock on the door next time. I mean, that's just 101. Come on. But yeah, she experiences the first awful feeling of danger, which is making a date with him. And when she comes home, her son, one of her sons, has had an unexpected accident. Like he's injured. And she immediately internalizes this guilt.
And I think he would.
Absolutely. But yet at the same time, like is able to move past it.
Yes.
Like don't worry about that. And we don't even come back to the kid really ever again, I don't think.
The kid who got a concussion and then was given a sedative to fall asleep. Not the way you want to treat a brain injury.
Doc, that's that call. That kid has CTE now. Oh, man, yeah. She even tells Fred about this strange man. And I went to the movie. He's doing his crossword again, asking for clues without a clue. Has no reaction to it. It's like, oh, that was very nice. She even's like, let's have him over for dinner. And he's like, yeah, great. Sounds good. And she just laughs. Either because she's just like, damn, this is going to be easy as shit. Or she's recognizing the absurdity of it. I think she would have us believe it was the latter. But I think there's a little more of the former in there.
One thing I wanted to pick up on was, so this is an expansion of the Noel Coward play, which is only set in the Milford concession room. So all the extra stuff with meeting her husband and the outside stuff doesn't happen. This was written for the movie.
Yep.
And I think they're not good people. Like the movie doesn't make them bad people, but there's not, she doesn't like her friends. She has no positive things to say. She avoids her friends. And not just because she may be seen, but she has to be like, I haven't seen this person for ages, but I'll quickly tell a lie about them. And
she even gets her friend wrapped up in a lie, right? She gets her to back up her lie to Fred with yet another lie, a lie to her and another lie to Fred.
Yeah. And then she says in one of the like most like heart-wrenching parts of it, she says, it's so easy to lie to you, to her husband. Like, because you trust me implicitly, you make it easy for me. And it's like, God damn, you are a bad person. Like, you're not guilty about that. You're just saying it.
Yeah, absolutely. But yet at the same time, you know, we're saying this, and yet you do as a viewer, like, absolutely, like, feel for her and sympathize and empathize with her and all these stuff. Like, you do get absolutely wrapped up in it. I think like what we're talking about is like this overall like subtextual thing of like, if you actually kind of scratch a little bit harder, you see like, that doesn't seem exactly right. Yeah, there's another time where she says something like, she's talking about Fred and she says like, how odd of you not to notice you were living with a stranger in the house.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's on her because she's a stranger in the house, but also you kind of screwed up on that one, Fred. Like, how odd of you not to, like, that was your bad. It's, you know,
also,
I mean, yeah. So.
She also flat out one time says, I wish I could die. I wish I could just die.
Yeah.
Like, she does, she kind of doesn't like herself. You know,
no, I mean, I think yeah.
any
and
situation
just,
she'd be in, I don't think she'd like it.
No, absolutely. No, and she just, that's why I think she just goes all in on this guy. She just finds something in it that it just like awakens something in her, and she just, she goes fully in on it because they talk about how, like, you know, we barely know each other.
Yeah.
You know, like we don't really know each other that well. And we were talking about, you know, unreliable narrator, and you were saying there's this kind of scene where they make a date, okay? And so this is their first date, right? She says, I'm going to go meet him out of politeness, right? And when he doesn't show, she happened to pass by the hospital. And we see her kind of start to panic because this is like, you know, he doesn't have a Facebook profile or anything like that. They don't have, like, they can't text or DM or anything like that. She'll never see him again, potentially, if like they don't make this date. And his train's leaving, her train's leaving, and he rushes in just in time for his train. He's always kind of rushing in. And we can't even hear his explanation or anything like that, but we just see, again, we see her face. And that's when I think she realized she was falling in love. And that's what's ironic is, like, they don't even have a date because he just rushes in and has to rush to his train, barely makes his train in time. And they say, let's meet again next Thursday. But it was just that moment of, I might never see him again. Oh my God. Like the terror, the emptiness she started to feel, that's when she realized I'm in love with this person, or at least I'm falling in love with this person. And again, like you talk about not knowing each other. This is the breakthrough. A date they never had. You know? Yeah. But so they do go to see this movie, Flames of Passion. Which is a good little bit of satire. This really bad movie called Flames of Passion, which does inflame their passion.
They duck
out there, right? Out they go. Again, they talk about, like, kind of connecting, and even though they don't really know each other. And there's just too much in the way. There's a lot of stiff upper lips kind of going on here. So again, I said very British. And this is like they're middle class. These people, I guess, upper middle class. So they're not wealthy. They're not poor, but they are very much beholden to like a social code and certain expectations. I think maybe this is the best shot in the film. And there's a lot of amazing shots. Like I said, it's much more subtle than something like Lawrence of Arabia, but there is this where they go from the train station to her at home. And it's like this fade that appears to have been done maybe in camera, or at least using like kind of old equipment, where part of the screen goes dark. She comes up sitting down, and then Fred kind of calls out to her, and then Fred comes up and fills the area that was left by this empty part of the train station. It's just this amazing, like, kind of like two or three part fade instead of just fading directly, and it fades part in and then fades the other part in. And again, it's just her like waking from the dream that is the idea of a life with Alec. And in a life with Alec, she's free. It's just her and Alec traveling the world, dancing at the opera, you know, doing all these amazing things. No kids, no husband.
They're
no,
younger, you know, somehow. Nothing.
Yes, exactly. They're richer and all this other kind of stuff. So yeah, it's just, it really is a fantasy, and she's living this fantasy. So it's like she sees it in the train window. So again, she's having almost like what, you know, that's a hallucination, you know. What, yeah, it's cinema, but it's also a hallucination. So she's really kind of like having this like kind of alter, you know, this dream idea of what life without could be like. And then there's the scene after that, which is another one of the best shots in the movie, which is her first lie, quote unquote, her first lie, as she's telling, you know, this is where I was, you know, today. And again, what I love is, again, the shot's on her face, but it's in the mirror now. We're seeing her face reflected in the mirror, because now she has two lives, right? So mirror Laura is telling one thing to Fred, you know. So, and then this is like she even gets her friend to back up her lie. Easier and easier. The more you do it. But again, they're always getting interrupted. Like they get interrupted at lunch by these idiot friends. They're getting interrupted at the train station by her idiot friends. The idiot friends obviously know what's going on, and yet they keep going. They keep going, unperturbed. All the way to Steven's flat. Oh, Steven. And she's torn. This is just a... this movie's just so many amazing sequences in this movie, but this one where it's going back to the flat, which means cheating on your husband with Alec, or it means going home and just giving up this dream life that you're living, right? She even gets on the train and gets off and finally... does choose Alec. But once again, judgmental friends, Quirky, always getting all up in your business, telling you what to do, saying, don't have sex with some woman on my couch just because I gave you the keys one time.
Yeah. And let me get that keypad back, pal. I don't know what you're running here.
Yeah. I might find somebody else. Just leave it under the mat.
I fucking love that part. I love that performance. That guy was so creepy.
Oh, I know, right? Like, that guy was just ripping him to shreds without really hardly, like, changing his expression or tone or anything like that. It was some British-ass shit. But again, I think this is the only scene in the film which is not from her point of view or where she's not part of it. That's right, isn't it? Like, I came back to that later. I was like, the whole movie... it's on her. It's all on her, except for this scene. Because she dashes out the second she hears Alec. They're on the couch.
Yeah.
He's making his move.
Yeah, she gets out of her coat really fast.
On bended knee. And he's ready to do it. But off she goes. And runs. I mean, this is... we talk about how Alec's always running. And this is how you can tell Alec is just so ardorous. He is... anytime he's... on the train station or coming out of the hospital, he runs to her. Like they know every second they want to just have together. But now she's running away in the rain. And even like a cop shows up and she says, I felt like a criminal. You know, like this is society is giving her a little bit of the stink eye right now.
You can't be a woman out by yourself after dark.
Now, what are you doing out here?
Smoking cigarettes outside?
Yeah. But, like, again, they just can't quit each other. Even though they've not consummated this relationship, right? Like, they've spent a few hours together, total, all in all. And yet, it's like, he says, we can't just stop. We can't just stop. Not quite yet, right? That's like like addicts, you know? Like, let's give an excuse to keep this going just a little bit longer. But we do finally come to the last day. And as it turns out, that was that first scene that we witnessed in the beginning of the film with these two just absolutely grave-looking people sitting together at this small table in the refreshment room at the Milford train station in Lancashire. And that friend coming in is just so much more horrible. Like, the second time around, the first time you're like, oh, yeah. Like, how many times have you been, like, trying to have an intimate conversation, and then here comes somebody, like, sticking their nose into it.
Mm-hmm.
But the second time around, when you know that these are the last seconds these people will ever spend together, this is, like, their lives are ending, right? Like, any kind of hope that they had, certainly for her, any hope that she had. He's heading off to South Africa with his family, to Johannesburg, to do, you know, whatever. But she's here. This is it. There's nowhere for her to escape to. She's stuck. And she has no options, and that's it. And her love is getting on a train. And in the last second, her idiot friend comes in, and they can't kiss goodbye. They can't say goodbye. They can't say I love you. They can't do anything. He just has to leave.
It's a Merchant Ivory type where just the hand on the shoulder is like...
just the hand on the shoulder. Yeah.
That's everything.
Age of Innocence shit. Yeah, this horrible friend. And Laura, again, just a a fantastic shot, but it's so subtle. It seems like it's a cliche, like the canted angle when somebody is like having a mental breakdown, right? Like that's a cliche. But the way that it goes in this shot from just a straight shot to like subtly canting, subtly tilting over, and suddenly as you realize like, oh shit, she's thinking about something really, really awful right now. Like again, her life's over. And in her eyes, she's just like, here comes the express train. The express train doesn't stop. Out I go, but she can't do it. Stop short, dead look in her eyes. But it's brutal, and it's a fantastic shot. And again, like it's sort of a cliche of a shot, but how it is... This is the thing about Lean, is that like he's not necessarily revolutionary as a filmmaker. He's not someone who like pushed the envelope necessarily. He's just really, really good at his craft.
He's just better than everybody else. There's nothing wasted in this.
It's just... The maturity of the storytelling and how that fits in with the camera work. It's no surprise that Steven Spielberg, huge David Lean fan. And apparently David Lean originally was developing Empire of the Sun.
I can see that.
In the 80s. Spielberg came on, and I think partly because it was like, here's my chance to make a David Lean movie. Here's my chance to kind of follow in the footsteps of my idol, literally, in this case. So yeah, it's just, it's very, very mature, smart, just adroit. He's an adroit motherfucker.
Yeah.
If I do say so myself. But yes, back to the living room with Fred, waking from her dream. And he says, thank you for coming back to me. And just the most like heartbreaking ending. She hugs him, she weeps again. Her life's over. She's come back to him, but in what form has she come back to him? Just horribly mangled version of herself, you know, just a dead zombie, emotional zombie version of herself, maybe. Like what could she possibly have to look forward to, you know? I guess except the kids getting out of the house or something. But yeah, it's a brutal ending, because it is like the lovers leave, you know. I mean,
that is very interesting. Leave, I had a different take on the ending.
What was your take?
Well, my wife and I, we watched it together, and both of us at the very end, like, we're like, because her husband says, you've been gone away for a long time, thank you for returning to me. And we're like, did he know? Did he figure it out? And it feels like he did. And
yes, almost, I think so too.
It almost felt like a happy ending. But again, well, that quote I brought up last time, a happy ending is only depends on when you end your movie. So like, do we see her 2 months later being
distraught?
This is
what I'm saying, yeah. That's what I think. It's not a tragic ending in the sense that like her jumping in front of the express train is
That'd be tragic. Yeah.
Right? Or you know, something to kind of put her out on the street without anyone or anything like that. But this just kind of turns us right back to where we were when she started the narration, which was that like, let me try to explain this thing. And he does seem to kind of have understood it, even though he couldn't, you know, hear the narration. But somehow, yeah, he does seem to come to some kind of understanding. But for her, what does that mean? She just breaks down into tears. They don't seem to be happy tears. She still seems very distraught to me. Yeah. So I guess ambiguous, but ambiguous in the sense of like, we've come to an understanding, but where do we go from here? I guess it's a... it's a little harsher version of like the Charulata ending of like the couple comes back, but we freeze frame because like, what does a reconciliation mean here? There's not love here.
No, it's an arrangement.
Like, this could be a good relationship. This could be a good marriage, but there's not love. There's not passion. There never was, and there never will be. So like, where do you go from here, knowing that that can exist for you in another person, you know? So like, yeah, it's not a happy ending. It's not necessarily a tragic ending. I think it is kind of a sad ending, and in its own way, kind of bleak. But you know, maybe that's just me. But Quirky, anything we wanted to bring up before we give our rating on Brief Encounter?
We haven't touched at all on the Rachmaninoff score that begins diegetically. She puts it on while her husband's doing his crossword, and she goes to talk to him. But it it's pretty throughout.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that the score, especially as we got kind of later into the film, that what we're seeing, if you kind of like just take yourself way out of it and just kind of list what happens, right? Like, it's a couple that meets up a few times, kisses a couple times, never really gets together, and then he goes off. You know what I mean? Like, and yet this gives it, I think the score gives it that feeling of like an epic love story, yeah, of something really grand. I do think it sort of elevated it, and it takes place in these very, nowhere very glamorous, a cafe, the chemist, theater, and the street corner, and a train station, and a living room. And again, they're middle class. They're not super glamorous rich people who lead very exciting lives necessarily, but I think it gave it that feeling of like, yeah, this sort of epic sweep. So I did like the score quite a bit. All right, well, let's rate this sucker, a sucker named Brief Encounter. I'll just remind everybody about our rating system. Of course, we rate on the sight or sound system. If we both think it was a sound selection, light it up, kaboom, into the cannon fodder, cannon you go, movie. If one or both of us think it was a little slight, or even a lot of slight, no cannon for you, movie, but we'll select a slighted movie, not in the Sight and Sound Top 250 to put in its place, a quirky Brief Encounter. Slight or sound?
This is a tough one for me. I'm so on the fence.
It's a high bar.
I'm going to go sound.
Ooh, it was a quiet tension.
I did say a movie like this, a romance movie for me, has to have a unique way to bring me in, and this one does. It very truly does, with the narration monologue to herself and the flashback to the series of dates, and that had me hooked. I was compelled. I keep using that word, but that's the feeling. I was into it. I wanted to know what happened next. I wanted to see her rationale. I wanted to see how far they got, and there were a lot of things that I thought was touching. I like the reflections of their relationship in the porter and the concession stand runner, and then the concession stand employee and the young porter. Like, even they have their own relationship analog. I like the mysteriousness, to where I was wondering, I'm like, does this guy even have a wife and kids? Like, he could be a total Lothario fucking playboy. Like, that was his fuck pad that he was going to take it to. So I like that there's some vagary still and things left out there. This will always live for her as this, you know, brief encounter of what could have been this, you know, her whole life. And then I liked also finding out that this was set in actually 1938. So it's pre-war, like the war. It's nothing to do with the feelings of like anything could happen. We could be losing our lives at any moment. This is just people that have an emptiness in their life. They can't help it. Oh, that was the big thing. You have made the awesome joke oftentimes during about romance comedies. These two people who aren't together except for all of the various reasons they should be and the none of the reasons they shouldn't be. The movie focuses on the none reasons, and like, it's this invented phoniness. This is very good reasons these people should not be together, but yet they can't help but need to be together. The spark was there. It happened. And they can't fight it. It's just, do they give in and how much? And all of that wrapped up into a small little bow, a quick little 90-minute movie.
87 minutes or something like that? Yeah. I agree. Sound. I think it's the very sound film. What a wonderful, 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 shockingly so simple and yet so surprisingly complex at the same time. And I'm glad you brought up the ticket taker and the woman at the cafe. It's Because it's kind of funny. It's almost like sort of the way like Shakespeare used Falstaff, right? Like different shades of English society. Because like Laura and Alec, again, they're very middle class bourgeois. So everything's like, oh, dear, pip, pip.
Yeah.
Spot of tea, spot of tea. And these two are working class and it's much more vulgar. It's much more like he slaps her on the butt.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. But she's also very loud. Yeah. You know, she's very loud. She's very talkative.
She pours her drinks like four at a time. So it doesn't.
Yes, exactly. Yes. But he smacks her bottom. He tries to steal a kiss and all these kinds of things. So he's, they're way, you know, much worse even at hiding it than Laura and Alec are. But I do love that they have this kind of, and just the way that she watches them and the way that they're watching her as well. And I agree. Yes, sound film. So that is two votes for sound. And that means that Brief Encounter and David Lean, welcome.
Welcome
to the Cannon Fodder Cannon. Nice to have you here. Is that really the first one? We haven't put in Bridge on the River Choir?
No.
David Lean, get in here, you old so-and-so.
All right, that's what we thought about Brief Encounter. What did you think about Brief Encounter? Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We would love to hear your take on the film. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app. Contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dare Daniel Pod. Tell us your thoughts.
And now, of course, it is time to randomly select the film we will review in 2 weeks on our next episode. Quirk, you ready to do this?
Let's go, baby.
The dice have been rolled. There are no dice. It's just a random number generator. But what do you got for us? We have The Night of the Hunter. Quirky. Night of the Hunter.
Oh, okay.
Fantastic film. This is one of my all-time favorite movies. Top 10, top 20 level type films. 1955 film directed by Charles Laughton. It's the only feature film Charles Laughton ever directed, if you can believe it. Robert Mitchum stars along with Shelley Winters and Lillian Gish. I will read the Letterboxd synopsis. In a Depression-era West Virginia, a serial-killing preacher hunts two young children who know the whereabouts of a stash of money. Quirky, are you familiar with this film?
I'm familiar with it. How could you not be if you're a fan of film? And I saw Desperate Hours or Desperate Measures, the remake of it in the early 90s, I believe. But I've never seen Night of the Hunter, no.
Yeah, it's a masterful film. If you want to watch it along with us, it is streaming with ads on Tubi. You can also rent it on any of your favorite VOD services. I feel like it plays on Turner Classic Movies fairly often. It's a stone cold classic. Absolutely gorgeous black and white cinematography, a haunting performance by
this is the Love and Fear Tattoos, yeah?
Yeah, so again, tying into Cannon Fodder inductee, Do the Right Thing, right? Like Radio Raheem does the love-hate speech. He takes it directly from Night of the Hunter. Written by James Agee as well. So just a lot of great people that work here. Cinematography by Stanley Cortez, one of the all-time greats. Just a wonderful film, and I'm excited to watch it again. It's been a while. It's been at least 15 years or so, I'd say. And to talk about it with you.
Until then, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu or look for the donate button. Become one of our long-haul supporters. If you're a fan of new movies, listen to Daniel review the top films of the day on Single Take with Daniel Barnes. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I'm the Daniel Barnes that Corky was just talking about. And until next time, save us a seat in the back row.